You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. .38 here on the Thursday morning, getting ready for the 4th of July weekend. And again, my thanks to Cal Humphrey for coming on, talking about the landing and his time that he spent on Iwo Jima. So we go out of the fryer and into the frying pan. Don Bennett joins us. We continue our discussion from yesterday. And, sir, first of all, I want to thank you for being flexible and coming back today. Your story is a great one, and happy to have you come back, Don.
Thank you very much. I had different things that I thought I should have covered yesterday, and one was, where were all the Marines when they started to put together the 1st Marine Division? I looked up a long time ago. There was 7,254 officers in the Marine Corps on 30 June 1950, and 67,025 enlisted men. Yet, there was not enough Marines to put that division together. Where were they at?
Where were they at?
Yeah, well, they were actually out in guard detachments. Every base, naval base, had a brig, and had a Marine detachment that did all of the security at the gates and around the installation. Also, out on the ships, every battleship, cruiser, and aircraft carrier had a Marine detachment. So that's where the tremendous amount was. The Secretary of the Navy sent a message to all of these guard detachments that they would send 50% immediately to Camp Pendleton by rank. And the message that I saw, the reproduction of it, said, they give you what 50% is. If you have 5 staff sergeants, you will send 3, not 2. And this was set out, and that brought a lot of men in, but on the ship, those detachments basically stayed there, except the ones in dry dock, and they sent a lot of them out to Camp Pendleton. I run into an officer many, many years later who was a Naval Academy graduate, and he more likely graduated in 1941 or 42 and had orders in 1950 to go back to the academy. Naval Academy to be an instructor. He was a Marine captain, so he bought himself a convertible, rented a real nice apartment, and was getting ready to go and report into the Naval Academy when he got a telegram said you were to immediately store your belongings and go to Camp Pendleton. You have been asked for. And all those colonels and the general could ask for any officer they wanted. And it was at all possible they broke them loose, and, of course, senior NCOs, and shipped them to Pendleton for the leadership that was needed when they called up 8,600 Marine Reserves who had never been to Marine boot camp, because in the 1940s, they didn't send the reserves to boot camp as they do now and have for a long time.
All right.
So here was a whole mass of men who had never been to boot camp. I happen to have a roster that I call the Incheon roster of Bravo Company, 1st Tank Battalion, and I counted up. There was 71 regulars and 61 reserves in it. So we had more than likely 42 or 43% of our company, and we was the 1st tank company they was forming after A Company left. So everybody got a big dose. But when it come around to the 7th Marines, they ended up with 42% of that regiment.
Wow.
Were reserves, and most of them had not been to boot camp. So this gives you an idea how short the Corps was of people. Then they had ordered a 2nd Division into Camp Pendleton. So, and there was a BLT, Battalion Landing Team, in the Mediterranean. And they ordered them to go through the Suez Canal and around to Korea. And I don't remember which unit they went to. I think they went to the 5th Marines, but I'm not sure of that. But it gives you an idea of how short, for before the Incheon landing, that we was, and a lot of us never had any training together. I had 4 men on my tank that had never been on a tank. And we had no business landing for combat with so little experience. But that's what happened. And I thought I would just hit that real quick. Do you have any questions on that, Mike?
You know, Don, I'll tell you what. I mean, I was thinking, you know, I listened to the interview again last night. And the picture, I mean, you know, I'm trying to think were you the one that said that Eisenhower said that we would never fight another war like World War II in our lifetime? And then a year later, we're in Korea fighting a land war.
Yes.
And, but you know, the country's mindset was, you know, we were gonna, you know, bring troop levels down, you know, to pre-World War II. Levels and get back to, you know, get back to being Americans. And in the midst of that, guys like Don Bennett, you know, go to Korea at the front end of that thing, and just was, you know, I would tell you, arguably, you know, Don, you were a part of one of the greatest periods in Marine Corps combat history. What this group, when you hear him kind of articulate where they came from, they get aboard ship and they go and fight, and they fight like Marines. You know, you never hear, you know, I've never in my life read anything that said, yeah, you know, these guys weren't well trained and they went ashore and they got their asses handed to them and they weren't tough. You never read anything like that. And it's a tremendous tribute, to the leadership and just to the Marines who taught each other. And Don yesterday talked about, you know, he first gets his hands and is able to drive, you know, their tank on a baseball field in Japan, and they ruined the baseball field pretty well, but they, you know, they learned. And did you get to do any gunnery in Japan? Because you talked about how different the smoothbore gun was from the gun on the 75 millimeter on the M4. Did you get to shoot it all before you went?
No, we didn't shoot around out of our machine guns, nor 90, because we picked them up at 32nd Street, the Naval Station, San Diego, off of flat cars, and they were driven maybe 200 or 300 yards to Pierside, where they were put aboard ship, a civilian ship, down in the bottom hole. We didn't see them again until we got to Kobe, Japan. Our captain we had was Bruce Williams. What a wonderful guy he was. He talked the civilian captain of taking 4 enlisted men, because they had 4 bunks in a cruise quarters, and one of the officers, and I believe it was Lieutenant Gover, who was my platoon commander, that he picked to send the one officer. The captain had one bunk in his own quarters. Captain Williams, many months later, I had asked him, why did you send those 4 men and a lieutenant on that civilian ship? He said, I wanted to make sure those civilians didn't steal our tools and our machine guns. That's what I really wanted to make sure that didn't happen. Plus, they needed to check the gripes on those tanks, which they did. And that was the excuse to be down in the holes a lot, checking, making sure nobody had broken any locks and gotten inside the tanks. So we didn't have the opportunity to fire that 90. I fired the 90, I think, on the third day. Now, we had torn it apart from reading the book, and we actually put the hydraulic oil into the gun system in Kobe, Japan, at that airstrip. And I foresighted the sights, the telescopic sight and the periscope sight for that 90. They're on a building out about 1,500 yards. But we took a tank, like it said, and pushed it in and out as I poured the oil in. So the first time, Eugene McGuire, I had made my gunner. And we was in support of the infantry and way out about 1,500 to 1,800 yards. I did some farmhouses, and I could see enemy troops headed into that hedge grove-like affair and the houses. So I took the opportunity to fire my 90. And I told the loader super quick, and he threw the round in. The breech actually closed. I knew that we'd put it together correctly. and then I said, enemy troops, 2 o'clock, 1,500 yards or whatever. And Eugene McGuire, my gunner, said on target, I said, fire when ready. And he said, firing. And I hate to admit it, I closed my eyes when he said fire. And I, that, on a 10, pardon me, on a 75 millimeter tank, World War II, it just barely moved the tank. Wow, this 90 millimeter rifle, high velocity weapon, when that went off, the tank reared back, and I opened my eyes, and that gun was in full recoil. And one of the warnings in the books was, if you didn't have enough oil circulated properly, you'd wipe out your radios. It was in full recoil. My radios were sitting there all right. And it came home, and the round bounced out. And I said, damn, we did it right. That's a terrible place to find out you did something right.
Again,
but that's how much training we had had. And I think that was the third day ashore. And that same day, the next day, so it must have been the second day. The next day, I'm out in front of the tank, and we're resupplying the 2 or 3 rounds and putting gas in my tank. And I grabbed my writing material and was sitting down in front of the tank, going right home and say, Mom and Dad, I made the Incheon landing. It's a couple of days beyond that. I'm fine. Everything's okay. It was kind of letter I was going to write, and the captain come by, and he said, Bennett, get a weapon. You're going to be my shotgun. And I bounced for about 10 miles in the back seat of a Jeep as we looked for the regimental commander of the 1st Marine Regiment. And when we found Colonel Puller, he was on a road up above a rice paddy, and on the top of his Jeep, he had a map. And around the Jeep were several people, 5 or so, maybe 6. And they were pointing at a long rice paddy, a bunch of rice paddies. And then the ground went up maybe a couple thousand, 3,000 yards out there. When my captain come up, he introduced himself. And Fuller was introducing him to the other people in that circle. When he stopped and he said to my captain's son, don't I know you from the past? And my Captain Williams stood at attention, and he said, Colonel, you promoted me to corporal on the USS Augusta, which was the flagship for the Pacific Fleet. And then Puller grabbed his hand and cranked on it and said, one of my men. We worked for Puller until he left Korea, and when he got selected for general. So I supported the 1st Marines the rest of the time that Puller was in charge. So I got to see the old man quite a few times and saluted him and what have you, maybe 100 times, 150 times in my life. So that was our start, very rocky, and we fought our way into Seoul, Korea, where we battled down the streets. By then, we had pumped out several rounds of that 90-millimeter ammunition and burned up a lot of 30-caliber machine guns, supporting the infantry as we fought down through the center of Seoul, Korea. And then when we got on the other side of Seoul, we headed up and went up to around where the 38th parallel was. So that was our early action.
My guest this morning is Don Bennett. We continue a conversation we started yesterday. Don, a native of Enid, Oklahoma, whose family moved to San Diego in the early 40s. He sold newspapers, ultimately joins the Marine Corps in 1947. The Marine Corps is being disbanded. He re-enlisted, at least that's what the president was intending. I told a story about about your signing the notice to the director of the Marine Corps historian, the history directorate, yesterday. And he said, you know, I've never heard of that. He said, that'd be fascinating to get our hands on. He said, I know there was much discussion, but just a recruiter probably doing a good thing, making sure that nobody could come back at him and saying, hey, he didn't tell me that. But he was fascinated by your story, Don. And then what we've been talking about is the state of the Marine Corps when the Korean War begins and what the 1st Marine Brigade, Don told yesterday, two companies, per battalion and a weapons company that probably resembled more of a weapons platoon than a company. That's what they deployed with, in those battalions that made up the 5th Marine Regiment that was part of the 1st Marine Brigade that left out of Camp Pendleton and went to the Pusan perimeter. And then Don told a story about, you just heard part of it, getting their tanks, training on the M4, the Sherman tank, and then going and getting the M26 in Japan, never not being able to train on it, not being able to zero it. And then, the first time they zero it is 3 days in after they land on Walmido Island, take the causeway over, and get into Seoul and fight their way through Seoul. Don, I've got an email question here for you.
Yes,
Mac, I've read so much about Chesty Puller. Did he have the same aura then as a colonel that he would have later on in his career after the Korean War? So did you know him by reputation at that point, Don? I mean, did the reputation that he enjoyed among Marines as a colonel, was he a bit of a Marine Corps legend even then?
Well, he was a Marine Corps legend because he had 4 Navy crosses.
Right.
And him and Lützenberg were both privates in the Marine Corps in World War I. So we knew a little about his history, and Lützenberg was no slouch, to say the least. And they were both regimental commanders who had started out as privates in the United States Marine Corps. So I knew that Puller had quite a reputation, and he was somebody that took a lot of interest in his troops and saw that they were taken care of. But he also demanded excellence from them, in my opinion. That's my recollection that I knew of him prior to seeing him shake my captain's hand and saying, one of my men, and then he never let us get away from him. B Company supported the 1st Marine Regiment the rest of the time until we left the Chosin Reservoir.
All right, let's talk about the Chosin Reservoir. So you guys make the landing, you get through Seoul, and then you push towards the northern part of the Korean Peninsula and towards the Yalu River. Was there any discussion ever, Don, about that the Chinese might enter this thing, or was there any discussion like that as you're headed north?
Well, in the first place, when we got up the 38th parallel, they brought us back to Incheon.
Okay.
Put us aboard ship, and we went around the bottom of Korea and landed at Wonsan, Korea. The Russians had mined the harbor, and it took about 2 weeks for the minesweepers to clear a path in so we could land at Wonsan. The North Koreans had collapsed so badly that the air wing had flown in and occupied the airstrip at Wonsan. When we landed, Bob Hope was putting on a show at the airstrip for the Marines in that squadron. So we had a lot of ribbing that Bob Hope beat us in. And we stayed around Wonsan for a week or two and then went up the road to Hamhung Hung Nam area and was guarding the Hung Nam area. And then we then went up to the bottom of the flat ground or the where the plateau started up the mountain. And that road rised up to the mountain, 3,010 feet. But the tanks couldn't go up that road. And no, we hadn't heard anything about Chinamen by the time we went to Wonsan. No, nobody even thought of them, at least down on my level. As a young sergeant, we weren't worried about the Chinamen. We didn't hear about them. But when we got up above Hamhung Hung Nam, the Marines run into Chinamen. I was not involved in that. And I think it was the 7th Regiment. And they had quite a battle down or about where the road started up to the Chosan Reservoir. And then they disappeared, you might say, and more than likely went up into the mountains above it. I couldn't go up the mountain with the tanks
right. Because
we were too wide. They sent the World War II tanks we had. Every company had, I think, three. It might have been two M4s with dozer blades on them. They hadn't figured out how to put a dozer blade on an M26. So we had some World War II tanks. And they could get up the mountain. And they went up to support the division, the 7th Regiment, and the 5th Regiment that had gotten up the mountain. That must have been about the 25th of February. And then the engineers worked on widening out the road where the M26 couldn't get up. It was a one-way road. And it had been built out of the cliffs there up to the reservoir area. So that was a long, long road. And it was, I'm trying to think, Delta Company, Dog Company, we called it in those days,
right. Got
the word to go up on the 27th. And we was to go up the next day, Bravo Company, Baker Company is what we called it in those days. And in the middle of the night, on the 27th March, I got woke up in the middle of the night and was told that the Chinese were attacking all over the Chosan Reservoir area and that we were going to, at first light, go and get up that road. Because Puller had one battalion left down where we was at, and he had two battalions, one at Quarteree, and he was starting to send us at least a company or two up to Udamni, I think was what they called it.
Right.
Where the headquarters was set up. So when we got up, we was living quartered for a couple weeks there, 10 days or whatever it was, in a schoolhouse next to these powder plants that the water from the reservoir ran. And when I, as a young fella, I said, oh, man, these wooden chairs would be nice. And when I tied, I think, three, maybe four, on the side of the tank and a little desk on the tank. So when we left, that was part of the gear that I had on the outside. that I didn't need. And it was daylight, and going up the mountain, they put trucks in between the tanks. And I had to run about a third of the way up that mountain when my driver said I got red lights come flashing on the engine. And I said, okay, keep me advised or something of that nature. And then shortly thereafter, he said, red lights on the engine are full and the transmission lights are flashing red on me. And I called Lieutenant Gover, my boss, and told him of my problems and asked to pull out of the column once I found a place wide enough for everybody to get by me. And after a couple of questions, he said, go ahead and do it. And he didn't want to give me permission to do it. I come around the curve, and it was a nice wide spot, and I pulled up against the side of the mountain, and all of the trucks and vehicles went on up the mountain. And I must have sat there 20 minutes or so, and more likely plus 10 degrees. It was still pretty cold. And the engine cooled off in about 20 minutes in the transmission. And then I just took it easy, not as hard as we was going. And when I got to the top of the pass, there sat about 7 or 8 trucks and 3 Jeeps headed downhill. And they was at the pass, and I saw nobody in them. And so I pulled up, and I no more than pulled up until a guy jumped out of a ditch and one come from behind a truck. The Chinese were shooting at them. So when those tanks and vehicles come up the mountain, somebody up in Quarter East said, oh, the road's still open. You people that were waiting to go down could. And that's basically what I think happened. And I told the couple of the guys that had come up next to the tank that I was going to Quarter Ree. They could come with me if they wanted. If they did, turn those trucks around. There was some of them that had got wounded. We got in the line. I jumped out and cut those desks off and left the Chinese some nice firewood or those chairs and the desk, and brought the gun out of travel lock and brought it around forward. I now was ready to do battle, and we basically drove the westerly way into Quarter Ree with little of no problem with those trucks. And I joined my company.
Don, let me ask you, can I ask you a question? So at what point, so you're at the reservoir, you know, things are moving well according to the plan. The North Koreans are still in disarray. Then things change, and all of a sudden you're fighting the Chinese. When did you ever get told, hey, we're surrounded by the Chinese? You know, they're trying to cut us off. Do you recall a moment when you were briefed on that? I mean, you obviously saw the chaos around you and what you were having to do to get back to Quarter Ree. But did anybody ever sit down and say, hey, let me just tell you what's going on? The Chinese have entered the fight, you know, and the 1st Marine Division's pretty much surrounded here because the 8th Army that was to our west is falling back. Did you ever have a moment like that?
No, it was just, we knew we were surrounded. We didn't know what was going on in the rest of the reservoir area or over where the Army was being badly beaten on the west side of the promontory of the country or the top part of the country. We were just interested and what was happening right there. And, of course, Puller had Quarter Ree.
Right.
And that's where he was at. He kept one of our platoons of tanks with him. And we then, about dark, tried to catch the Drysdale convoy that left at first light and charge on up. So it was getting dark as we left Quarter Ree. About 8 tanks, 9 tanks, and a bunch of trucks and a Jeep or two. And when we got, after it turned dark good, we was going up the road. I was maybe the 3rd tank back. our captain come to a point where there was burning vehicles, and way up ahead of those vehicles, there were two groups shooting at each other. Captain Williams did not have communications with them. He had communication back to Corderie. He'd been calling in. He called in a couple times, shot of artillery. But that's only communications. He didn't know which one is the enemy,
right,
which one is the Marines or the soldiers. There was a company of U.S. Army in that convoy,
right,
as well as a company of U.S. Marines in that convoy. And they had taken Delta Company tanks and whole had been in that convoy. So my captain decided we'd turn around and go back to Corderie.
Okay. Now, let me ask you, so how far west did you get? Did you get to the so your company gets how far to the do you guys get to Udom Knee? Do you get to the reservoir? Do you get to are you approaching the reservoir when this thing happens?
Well, I was maybe 6 or 7 miles from the maybe 8 miles from the reservoir.
Okay.
When we run into these burning trucks and the people shooting at each other.
Okay.
Our captain turned us around to go back to Corderie.
And that's where
Puller was at.
And that's what Puller was. And
yes.
With the 1st Marine Regiment up at Corderie holding that is instrumental to the 7th Marine Regiment, which was at Udom Knee, and the 5th Marine Regiment being able to kind of get in a circle and fight their way to Corderie and then get back to the coast. So talk to us. So the next phase is you guys have to hold that stretch of road. How the hell did you do that?
That night was a real tough night for us because after we turned around and went about a mile, an anti-tank weapon of some type hit the lead tank, knocked the track off. And that was the 3rd Platoon of the Bravo Company, and it was B-33. They got the crews out and went on to Corderie, and we with trucks, and there was about 4 tanks, 5 tanks in the rear portion. One of our tanks in our company had not made it up because of engine problems up the mountain. So when we got attacked, it was so dark. And it was not long. I was shooting my 90, and I had it down in the ditch where the Chinamen were at, or, you know, pointed at them. And it must have fired about 3 or 4 90s when my loader, Frenchie Lorette, was throwing in around, and it stopped at least a foot to 18 inches from going all the way in. We couldn't get it out. We couldn't get it in.
Yeah.
So then when I got up and I looked back, and the tank behind me was on fire. My 90 had been knocked out because some infantryman jumped up and shot up the tube.
Nice.
And I looked back, and I had 5 friends in that tank that was on fire. So I backed into it, and they jumped out. McGuire, who was my gunner, he was peeking out of the loader's hatch. And when we got up and hit that tank, he jumped up with a Tommy gun. He got waist high and come tumbling back in. He'd been hit. And my interest then was to get that hatch closed, which I did. But
nobody would throw a grenade down the hatch, right?
That's correct. Okay. I didn't want a grenade inside with it.
Yeah, not good.
And I called the lieutenant, who was up the road with a few trucks fighting his own war with about 3 tanks, and told him that 1-5 had been on fire. It was burning. And I backed into him, and McGuire told me that he saw them jumping up and getting out of the tank, but they were falling, and he thought they got wounded or killed. So I told the lieutenant, I had told the lieutenant I would wait 2 minutes and see if I got a response. And I thought later, after I told him that, why did I say 2 minutes? So I watched that second hand go around twice, once he told me that I could do that. And then I added another 30, 40 seconds, told my driver to start easing away from 1-5, the tank that was on fire. As I was telling my driver to pull away, over my intercom, come Bennett, don't move the tank. It's Swearinger. Swearinger was a tank commander in the other tank. He had gotten up and grabbed the tank infantry phone off of my tank and had pulled it underneath the fam. He had his crew under my tank. Wow. I tried to drop my escape hatch, and it didn't come out. It was frozen in, and he heard the bad news. So I said, I think we ought to get away from your burning tank. He agreed with me, and he scooted. I said, you control the driver from down there. And he did, and then we went 25 or so yards away from my burning tank when Swearinger told me he was tired of scooting. And so then I said, how am I going to get that escape hatch out? And I had thought about that. Morgan was my assistant driver, and I told him, drop your seat all the way down, take the backrest off. I'd seen him do it, so I knew he could do it. And I make sure that the hatch is unlocked. And the driver got up high enough that he could see down and said, yeah, it's unlocked. And I said, okay, take a full 30 caliber box and get back as far as you can and throw it at that escape hatch. And about the fifth or sixth time he threw that box out, the escape hatch dropped out, and all at once I no longer had 5 men in my tank. There was another 5 coming in.
Wow, had to be, what a great feeling. Hey, Don, let me ask you, I've got 3 emails here.
Okay.
Mac, I'm listening to Don, and it's stunning to listen to, you know, the Battle of the Chosen Reservoir. What was the weather like? We've read so much about how bitterly cold it was. We've seen the pictures. So, Don, okay, what was the weather like?
Well, it was 30 below zero, I believe, the night I'm talking about. It was snowing, and it was so dark that you could not see very far. In other words, it just, when it snows and there's no moonlight or getting out, we had a hard time. Our sights were useless for the 90 when we fired the 90 before they shot up the tube and of my tank. And that was a 30 caliber machine gun. But the weather was cold. It's snowing. There was little or no light. And I told the lieutenant that I had all of those men in the tank. And pretty soon he calls me and says, are you sure you've got them all? And you can imagine how tight it is in a turret.
Right.
It's made for 3. And now you think you've got 8. Well, I actually only had 7 in there. So we counted noses, and we was missing Hendershot. And later on, and a couple of times in my life, I asked Hendershot, why didn't you stay under that tank? He was dead. He went down to where the other tanks were at and were yelling to let him into their little perimeter they set up. And the lieutenant was checking with me to see if I had got everybody in, which I had not. And didn't know it. I asked Hendershot, what did you do? He said, it was so dark. He said, I was afraid the Chinamen were going to find out we was under the tank. He said, they was all around it, some of them marching by. So he said, I scooted up from underneath the tank, stood up, and walked with the Chinese. And then he said, we went a ways, and I peeled off and let them go on. And that's how I got away. So I was upset that he hadn't crawled up in the tank.
And here you are, pissed.
But anyway, it was very, very cold. One of my friends, the guy who I said was at the Naval Academy and got the orders to go to Pendleton,
right?
His job was to take the temperature every night. He was in the artillery. And he told me many years later that on the last 2 or 3 nights of quartery, it got down to minus 50. To close to the minus 60.
Wow.
Once it gets below minus anything, it's awful cold.
Well, you know what? I lived up in North Dakota, and the coldest weather I was ever in was, I want to say, was 30 below air temperature and the wind chill at 50 below. But at about, once you get to 20 below, stuff just starts to break. You know, 10 below, I think most stuff still functions fairly well. You get to 20 below, and it's just not made for that. And cars just, they start to break. And I can't imagine. I've got another email for you. Mac, I've seen images from shortly, probably after the period of time Don's talking about. The 1st Marine Regiment holds Cote-au-Rie. They hold the road coming from the Chosin Reservoir to Cote-au-Rie, and the site of the 7th Marines and the 5th Marines with their equipment, with bodies strapped to vehicles, trying to bring out everybody that they could. Could Don talk about what it was like to see that? Did he watch that as the 5th Marines and 7th Marines came back to the 1st Marines, and what was that like to watch?
I stood up on the road when the units first started coming down the road that had made it from to Cote-au-Rie. And I was looking for a friend, a kid that had lived next to me before World War II, who had moved to Texas and had joined the Marine Corps. And I knew he was in the George Company 7th Marines. So I was up there asking if it was George Company. And I found out at that time that these units that were coming by, seldom was it even a platoon, because they had been pulled off to hold a hill, and then if they needed some more people, there was a squad went up from another unit to help them. So it would become a real piecemealed amount of mix of people that just fought together to get down that road. Many a PFC turned around and said, You come with me. And they followed a PFC, and they might have been a corporal or a sergeant themselves, because a guy stood up and they went up and plugged a hole. That was the type of comradeship or friend looking after each other that happened in that Marine division. And I finally gave up waiting and trying to find my friend, went back over to my tank, was on the line, not far from the road where they was coming in, and went to sleep. And about an hour later, somebody was shaking me, and it was my friend who knew I was in tanks that I had known during late World War II, that went to Texas. And he was a machine gunner in George Company 7. Him and his squad leader were the only two Marines. Both of them were carrying a 30 caliber machine gun with a tripod, and both of them had one or two cans of ammo strapped to them. They stayed with me about 2 days and ate and slept. Then they put out a call for everybody from the 7th Marines to go to one area and everybody from the 5th Marines to go to another area, where they sorted them out and got them into the right companies and put them together to go on down the mountain across the bridge that had been blown by the Chinese, where the water went down to the power plants from the Chosin Reservoir. So that was a time when these men made it on down to where their units might have been. They had set up tents, warming tents, and had hot food, but my buddy and his squad leader, the only two left in their machine gun section, stayed with me for a couple days next to the tank, and we were feeding them and letting them sleep. So that's my recollection, and it was very cold during that period of time also.
My guest this morning is Major Don Bennett, United States Marine Corps, retired. He's a tanker. And we're talking about the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir and moving from the reservoir, essentially the 7th Marines, the 5th Marines moving that were on the other side of the reservoir Don was with 1st Marine Regiment with Colonel Chesty Puller, and they were at Coterie, and the 5th Marine Regiment, 7th Marine Regiment had to fight their way back. And, Don, did you ever feel like, as you guys pulled out of Coterie, headed for the coast, did the Chinese, did they pursue you, or had they taken enough lumps that they left you your space and maybe tried to give you a little bit of a tough time? But as you pulled away, did they continue their pursuit, or did they leave you all alone?
Well, I was the last of a couple tanks that, as we left Coterie, the Chinese, there was a stack of things that they didn't feel they needed to take with them that they'd piled up, and they started a fire. Well, that's where the Chinese headed. They was trying to get something warm, something to eat, and I put a few rounds in that group as they headed for that area. The battalion of the 1st Regiment that did not make it up the mountains before the attack was then fought their way up to where that bridge was at and measured and decided what was going to have to happen to get the division past that blown-out bridge. And they held that area, and the Chinese did fight them as they occupied that area and tried to hold it. When we fought out, when Puller's outfit, they dropped bridge sections, and I saw those dropped. One of the miracles was there was two trucks that were made to handle those bridge sections, and they was all the way up with the 7th Marines for some reason. The miracle was they had bullet holes all over them, but the two crews were still with those trucks. And that was, for the Army, that was really something. And, they was able to pick those bridges up, and Puller's unit fought down to where that bridge was at with those trucks right up towards the front. And they installed those, and we started putting people across on a bulldozer, TD-12 or whatever they called them in those days, pulling a earth mover, went through the center, and they had a terrible time getting it out. And then they decided they wouldn't have that center because it got smashed up. And one of the colonels did some math, and they figured that if they moved these sections to a certain point, the jeeps and the trucks and the tanks with great guidance could get across them. Wow. And so they lost about a half day getting that in. But as we left Coterie, we did not have much resistance. The lead units got shot at. One of our tank commanders was shot, and Puller took that man. He was dead. Some sniper from somewhere got him, and Puller strapped him to his jeep and hauled that dead Marine tank commander down the mountain so he'd have a decent burial. We thought the world of the leader of the 1st Regiment. I'll answer any other questions you want, sir.
Let's do this. I have one more question for you. It's an email question. He says this. Mac, can Don talk about the feeling of getting down to the port and getting on shipping after what they'd been through during the previous period? What was that? It must have been great relief. The tanks, obviously, probably some of the last things to get on shipping as everybody else moved through, Don. Or what is your memory of that, and how relieved were you having fought all that distance with the 1st Marine Regiment and hopefully being on to better things?
Well, the 1st Marine Division got aboard ship at Incheon to go around and make a landing at Wonsan. It was a good feeling to get back and talk to your buddies. And one of the important things, because I stayed in the Marine Corps, I talked to other Marines about their mental problems.
Right.
With things that happened. And so I was always a guy that went to the reunions, and I had reunions at my house for my company, mm-hmm. et cetera. We was able to talk about what had happened, and were well rested by the time they cleared those mines out of the harbor, and we got the opportunity to go ashore and spend a week or so while the Marines were given orders to go on up to Ham Hung Hung Nam, which we all made that trip.
Mm-hmm.
And one of Puller's problems was that he couldn't get his units released by the Corps commander to move on up with the rest of the Marines. That's why he ended up with one battalion that never got up the mountains.
Right.
But they was the ones that fought up to where that bridge was blown and held the area until we fought down to them and got across it.
What kind of feeling was it? What kind of feeling was it to get back on when you guys got back on? When you finally moved down to the port and got back on ship, that had to have been a good feeling.
It was a terrific feeling. I myself ended up being the last tank to go up the mountain and make it, or the last vehicle.
Wow.
And then on the way out, there was five tanks behind me that didn't make it. And I become the last tank and stayed at that bridge with the two of tanks, stayed at the bridge with that they'd put in with the engineers. And we blew the, they blew that bridge, I think, about 2:33 in the morning of the night, more like the 11th of December. And I had the offer, and the engineers went flying by me that had blown the bridge, and then these two tanks made it down the mountain by themselves. And I ended up, they didn't expect those two tanks to make it, most likely, because they were surprised when I showed up at Ham Hung at the harbor, and it was a great feeling to eventually get aboard ship and say, we made it.
Wow. What a story. Don,
yeah, I can go into great depths, but I won't.
You know what? I want to we have to take about a three-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk about Vietnam. I want to talk about mental health. And then I want to talk to you on a regular basis. You go down and talk to recruits, and I want to talk about that. So we're going to take a quick break. My guest this morning is Don Bennett, and he is a tanker from both the Korean War and from the Vietnam War. We're going to talk about Vietnam here in a minute. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
.933 here on the West Coast. On a Thursday, 4th of July weekend coming up. Everybody getting ready for that? We continue our discussion with Don Bennett, Major, Tanker, and just talked about the Chosin Reservoir. And Don, final question about your time in Korea. After you board ships, after the Chosin, where did you go and what did you spend your time, the rest of the time for the you were in Korea? What were you doing?
Okay, when we got I got on LSD, and, you know, they just brought the LCU up into the ship. While we was waiting to go aboard ship, I was standing there, and one round went off. Somebody had taken the machine gun and took the belt out, but failed to take out a round. And a friend of mine I was talking to got a bullet right through his knee. He just died in the last year, so I was a longtime friend of his. But he, when we left the harbor, that was a disaster. That our one of our good friends that had made it all that way got it in the knee. from somebody making a stupid mistake of not clearing that machine gun and getting that round out of the chamber. But that those are the kind of things that happen. We had a ride down to Mason, Pusan area. It was actually Pusan. And when they took my tank off of the ship, they did it by crane, and they left about 2 or 3 feet of getting it all the way down, and the crane dropped it. And because of that, my rear left sprocket fell off, and I had to be towed to an Army maintenance section. It caused them quite a bit of trouble. The only thing I could figure out is I hit the side of that mountain that night numerous times if we come down with that left sprocket, or at least the guy driving did.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to Mason, where we reorganized, and after a couple of weeks, they moved us to an airstrip on the East Coast, and Marine Air was using that airstrip. And we were put down there as on a perimeter to the airstrip as protection. It wasn't long until kind of a rest and recuperation area. We were sent on patrols on foot looking for North Koreans that had got left behind and Chinese who got through when the Army was retreating so rapidly. We climbed mountains. On one of those climbs, run into an area. I think they were South Korean soldiers, but they had died on the spot fighting and were still rotting away there because the snow had pretty much disappeared. So that was kind of a shock. But these men had fought for their country, and we went on our way. But we made patrols. We only got shot at one time. And a friend of mine named Pillsbury got it in the rump and got evacuated. He later got out of the Marine Corps, went to college for a couple of years with a good friend of his, and they both become Marine fighter pilots.
Wow.
So it didn't ruin him for life. It just got the cheek of his rear end and got him evacuated. That was our only casualty there as we guarded the airstrip. And then they brought us up and by a train and a road, we got into the central front. And as we pushed forward, we run into 2 or 3 times convoys of U.S. Army who had gotten ambushed, and some of them were still lying partway up hills and et cetera. So that was another sobering experience. But we fought in the central front until we got up above the 38th parallel. And I was sent home in July of 1951, and I went to MCRD and became a drill instructor. So that was my time that I spent there. We had different actions. By now, Puller's gone. We supported the 7th Marines. We supported whoever needed tank support instead of Puller having total control of us because he had left and become a general.
All right. So now, you go back to MCRD. And talk to us, what do you do between the wars? What year do you go to Vietnam?
I went to Vietnam in 1966.
All right, so tell us about your tours between Korea and Vietnam. So the first one is the drill field, and then you go get commissioned, right?
No, not then. I was a drill instructor, and I had several platoons. One of the platoons I had, more than one, I had about 3 platoons with a fellow that was named Gillian. Ambrioso Gillian was his name, and he was a sergeant. And he was great to have around because he'd been seagoing. And they had a hold on him so he couldn't go to Korea. And we pushed the platoons together. And then his job was up where they were working on the atomic bomb in New Mexico, White Sands. He was a guard there of the bomb. He escorted the bomb out to where they tested him. So he had a lot of experience around the scientist. And they call that the Curtis Detachment. The Curtis was a ship they changed, refigured for the purpose of carrying the bomb to and from and the better quarters for the people that went on it.
Right.
So these people off of the Curtis Detachment were held at MCRD and not let go overseas. Well, finally, the communists exploded a bomb, and Sergeant Gillian was sent overseas, and I sure missed him. I was then sent on INI duty, which is being a regular with a reserve tank unit. I was there to teach tanks. I ended up being the recruiter, going out and finding the ex-Marines, former Marines, and getting them to come to the unit, plus occasionally teaching something about the tanks. We had...
Did you do that in San Diego?
Yes, yes.
Out there by what? By Camp Elliott? Where'd you do it?
They was actually at MCRD. And they were down at the end of the, right by the bay.
Wow.
The airstrip ended and all the planes took off over us. And then the present airstrip is more likely at least 1,000 yards longer than it was in those days.
So you had some room at the end of the airfield.
Right. And we taught driving. Yes, we had there and then to the bay, all the way to the bay. They had left it open, and there was, so we had quite a bit of area we could drive the tanks for the reserves. We took them to for summer camp up to Pendleton, but we were right there in that area. I had a period of time, 1955, I went up to Pendleton, but I'd like to tell you about Sergeant Gillian. He ended up being the last Marine to get the Medal of Honor in the Korean War. In fact, the last person. And I tell the Marine recruits about him and show them the picture. I lent him my 36 Ford with a 47 Merth engine in it to go home on leave. And miraculously, that Apache Indian got back. And that car was still in great shape. He was a good Marine.
And you can tell because that wasn't always the case. Those cars did not always come back in one piece.
That was very much of a miracle in itself. So I was proud that I had served with Sergeant Gillian as my junior drill instructor. Great experience. Learned about, a lot about him taking the bomb, being around the scientists, et cetera. I went on INI duty, and from INI duty, I went to Camp Pendleton. When I got to Pendleton, they had a new tank, the M48 was coming in, and they had the flame tanks.
Ooh.
I thought they were World War II flame tanks, and I knew the old M4 well, so I kind of volunteered to go to the flame platoon. Well, they come up with the M67, which was a flame tank that would carry 400 gallons of napalm.
Wow.
So I spent time at Camp Pendleton, 1st Marine Division.
What did they call that tank? The M-what?
I think it was M-67.
The M-67 flame tank.
Yeah, it was a flame tank, and it would carry 398 gallons, I believe, was the actual amount that you could get into that container. And it took 3,000 pounds of air to shoot a load. So you had to mix the napalm. You had to compress the vehicle. So I ended up at Pendleton. After a while, they give us the old World War II tank park because we was away from the rest of the tanks. And so when we mixed napalm, we wasn't endangering other buildings or tanks. With having a fire or something. I never had a fire, but I did have some close calls. But we went out and put on demonstrations and let the Marines of the day know about this tank that looked like it had a gun, a regular gun on it. It wasn't hardly as long as a 90 millimeter, but it looked from a distance like a gun tank. And there was no doubt.
Wow.
You had to be up real close to it to realize that it wasn't a regular gun.
Because that was one of the complaints about the flame tanks in the Pacific, was that there was a tube that ran along the parallel, which was actually the lighter, that ran parallel to the barrel, and then and that's how you ignited the napalm, but it was noticeable. It was noticeable, and so this gun didn't have that?
No, it had two spark plugs, great big spark plugs, and you had to spray a gas that went across those spark plugs. That gas had about 150 pounds or so, and it sprayed across those great big spark plugs, and that's how you ignited it. You could shoot it without the ignition, and then as you finished, you put a lot of napalm out there, you shoot that last few seconds of it lit, and then you had a nice fire.
It
would shoot 300 yards.
But it didn't shoot that far if it was flaming, would it, or would it?
Well, it went just about as far, yeah.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay.
A terrific weapon. So anyway, I was in the flame platoon, a platoon sergeant. I went to Okinawa in 1957, went to the 3rd Tank Battalion, and of course, they found out that I was coming. They were going to get this flame tank and get rid of the World War II ones. And, of course, I got when I got there, they said, congratulations, you're going to be the platoon sergeant of the flame platoon and teach these people about the new tank that we're getting, et cetera. So I did that for about 4 or 5 months. And a friend of mine named Lynn Mattioli, who was a prisoner of war and escaped from the prison camp, was the staff club manager. He wanted me to be his assistant. The colonel said no. Bennett is to the battalion commander. The end result of that particular deal was that a little bit later, and I had 4 children at home,
mm-hmm.
little ones, and extra money was an important item to me. So they had an officer club job come up, and I had a brand new lieutenant I wasn't sure about that was become the platoon leader. So I figured if the colonel said I was too important for the staff club, he'd say the same thing for the officer's club. But he didn't. So I become the officer club manager, and the colonel said, well, whenever they need you, they can have you come down and show them how to mix or compress. You can do both jobs.
There you go.
So on Okinawa, in the last 7 or 8 months, I had the officer's club at Camp Hansen. And that led on, that officer club job let me know my company commander when I first got to Vietnam. Okay.
Wow.
And a couple other officers, say the least.
Was it the officer club up on the hill?
Officer club was off to the side in a double Quonset hut.
Okay.
And had built a little deal on the side of it. They'd done a pretty good job with 2 Quonset huts and parachutes and what have you.
Well, the one I went to years later was a lot nicer than that, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I went to that one, too.
All right, so let's fast forward. Talk to us about getting ready to go to Vietnam.
Well, when I got ready to go to Vietnam, I was on recruiting duty in Ogden, Utah. And Vietnam was a war that we should and did mostly win. The President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, made 2 mistakes. When the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was passed, in Congress, he considered that an act of war. And only two senators voted against it, and all of the representatives voted for it. He could have got a declaration of war, which would have meant any ship or people that was in North Vietnam could have been targets. Number two, very short, while I was still on recruiting duty, he said anybody going to college would be draft exempt. Well, a little town I was in had a two-year college that overnight become a four-year college.
Right.
And the people that didn't want to go to war all at once were students. So that was the second mistake that the president made. And so by the time I left recruiting, why did I leave recruiting? I had picked up master sergeant in the fact that I was on the list. I was down at the bottom of the list. And so I knew I was going to become a master sergeant when I got a list with my name on it with about 300 other sergeants to become warrant officers or lieutenants. And I called headquarters Marine Corps because I'm colorblind. And I told them I didn't want to be turned down again for a commission, go take the test and make out the super secret, asking for secret clearances, and et cetera, only to be, and in the end, told me I'm colorblind and they couldn't use me. The colonel on the other line said, look, I looked at your record book 3 months ago, and I stopped a set of orders at that time for you to go to Vietnam then. So you're going to go as a second lieutenant or a gunny sergeant. So make up your mind which and call me back. So I thought about it. I lost, I believe, $42. It was around $40 becoming a second lieutenant because I had almost 19 years of in the Corps at that time, 1966.
Wow.
So there, I checked the pay scale and decided it would be worth $1.30-some a day to be able to make my own life and death decisions rather than being a gunny sergeant trying to convince an officer this is not what we're going to do, what we should do. So I accepted the commission because I wanted to make my own life and death decisions in Vietnam. While I was in Vietnam, after maybe 8 months or so, I got my master sergeant warrant again, and I lost approximately $80 a month at that time. And from there, I went to MCRD, where they sent me, just as they did from Korea, to work with recruits. I was a series officer for a couple years or year and a half at least. And they sent me to work in the regimental headquarters for a short time. And I got a call while I was doing that, and the officer there on the line said, Don, I want to ask a favor of you. And I said, well, what is that? And he said, I'd like for you to go to the I&I staff of the 1st Tank Battalion, which was at Elliott then, and become the assistant I&I. And I said, well, that sounds good. And he said, well, the reason for this is we've got a Naval Academy graduate, first lieutenant there, and the colonel is giving him a couple of fitness reports that would end the man's career. We want to get him out to where he functioned real great in Vietnam, but right now he's getting those fitness reports that's not conducive. So I took, and he says, you're in San Diego. There'll be no cost of sending you to Miramar or Elliott to be on the I&I staff, and we can get that lieutenant out of there. And so that's where I went and served a couple years again. I'd served on that I&I staff, and just almost the same pattern. I went from being a DI to that I&I staff. I went from being a series officer and involved in recruit training out to be the assistant I&I of that tank unit. So I served there about 9 months or so. I was, when they ended the war and they cut the size of the Corps down, they had a continuation board. And after Korea, 60 or 70%, in my opinion, of the officers were retained as officers and were not reverted back. Well, I knew the same thing would happen because they told us that when we accepted commissions. But this time they only picked one out of nine to retain a commission. So I was that one guy that they kept in. So about 9 months after I was there and I'd been selected for, you know, a permanent commission, and I was a captain, I got a phone call from a fella, and he said he was my replacement. And he was in Minnesota, and he was inbound. So I called the fella that called me and asked me to go out there, and he told me 2 years would be about when I would do to go overseas, and I'd stay there. And here 9 months have went by, and there's somebody coming in to relieve me. He said, oh, Don, don't worry about that. That's a mistake. And then a few days later, I called him back, and he says, I don't know how I'm going to explain this, but he said, here's what happened. Somehow your card got in with all the other people they were reverting back, and you was being retained. And I just didn't look at those cards. I just handed them to the NCOs and said, find replacements. And the guy that's coming in, he's got a set of orders. And I said, well, you're going to be sending me back to Vietnam ahead of time. He said, yes. And he said, well, let me see what I can do. And in a few days, I called him back, maybe a week later, and he said, how would you like to work for the Navy? I said, doing what? He said, being a combat cargo officer. I said, get me a West Coast ship. And that is how I left the tank field, basically. I become a combat cargo officer after I went to school, and I was assigned to the 5th, what do you call that? Squadron of amphibious ships, Comfibron 5, and I was the Commodore's Marine. I was the one that went out and saw the Marines, planned their loads, and helped them get aboard ship, arranged for piers, and whatever the Commodore asked me to do. So that's what happened in my early career, and I've been selected for a permanent commission.
Don,
and that was about 1972. Well, I'd say 72. But no, it was about 1970.
All right. I want to end our time today, Don, with you go talk to the recruits on a regular basis, and you've had a pretty amazing career, given your time at the Chosin Reservoir, your time in Vietnam, and then what you saw before you went to Korea, and just, you know, your longevity in the Marine Corps. What are the things that you tell Marine recruits about what they're about to embark on and about their training and what it is to be a Marine? What is your message to them?
Well, my message is to them is they are the finest quality of men the Marine Corps has ever had. They're all high school graduates. They all had to cut a real good score to get in, and they could have no police record, a minor little offense, and they had to wait for a long time to get a clearance on that if they made it. So they're the best quality, and I explained to them how poor the quality many years ago during the Vietnam and the Korean conflict was. And I take them back to 1950 and tell them how bad off the Corps was, much of what I just covered with you about having to move the 2nd Marine Division out here, having an understrength regiment going over. But I stress leadership. But I get back and tell them how important boot camp is because I use the statistics from the Korean conflict, the prisoners of war. Are you aware that only 200 and... 221 Marines were captured?
No, I was not.
49 of them were officers, 172 enlisted men. 31 of those officers were aviators who got shot down. 18 Marines together escaped from the prison camp. One of them was one of my friends, Lynn Mattioli. He was one of the 18. The communist leadership said they're going to put all the troublemakers in one prison. And so they didn't miss any troublemakers. All the Marines would be put in that prison. The old master sergeant from the wars in Nicaragua or something, when he came in, took charge. And they looked after each other. And the death rate in that prison camp for Americans was 38.8%. But what was it for the Marines? 11.2%. One of my five friends that got captured died in a prison camp, but one of them escaped. And you look at there were 18 out of 172, I think it was, enlisted men, escaped. They all escaped together. One soldier escaped out of nearly 7,000 prisoners. And I tell those recruits, what is the difference? It's the training you're just having now. You're learned to be great followers and take orders, but you also have learned, because you was a follower, to be a leader. And you can't be a leader if you can't follow also. And so I build value in what they have just, the training that they have just gone through. And I give them these statistics. 19... I might be off on number 21. Americans refused to go back to United States and went to China to live with the Chinaman. Now, that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And one Brit did, one British soldier. Now, none of them were Marines. I took this out of the official reports that the Army did. From riding back on ships and going to hospitals with all these previous prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
They must have court-martialed 50 or 60 former prisoners for their actions as prisoners, U.S. Army. I tell them how lucky they was that the Army recruiter was not in town when they decided they was going to go, but the Marine recruiter was. That's why they got the good training they just have. And then I tell them that when the Constitution of the United States hangs by a string, which I think it will, you men and former Marines are going to follow the leaders of the country who want to save the Constitution. I tell them they will be the ones that help these leaders save the Constitution. So that's kind of how I leave that. I have a card which I call the title. And that title is something I read them, and I give them a copy of that when I finish my talk. And the phenomena of talking to these young men, usually about 75 to 80 of them, a platoon, I call it the locker box talk, because we actually go in the barracks on Monday that it's day of the parade practice. They're going to graduate on Friday and talk to them. And I read them this card that I'm going to give you, and it's the title. It cannot be inherited, nor can it ever be purchased. You and no one alive can buy it for any price. It is impossible to rent, and it cannot be lent. You alone and our own have earned it with your sweat, blood, and lives. You own it forever, the title United States Marine. And these kids save those cards for a long, long time and hold them very dear, because I've had these cards brought back to me by somebody years later and thanked me for having given them that card. So that's what I do when I talk to the Marine recruits. I call it the heritage talk. I give them a background of the Marine Corps history, about an hour and a half. One of the fellas that was in the convoy with me when we got ambushed at there as we was trying to go from Cotterie to Hagaru, was in my company. He's one of the people that gives the talks, but he was a mechanic riding in a truck, and he was shot at very much. And then one of the fellows that gave a talk actually served in my the company I was in, Charlie Company Tanks, in Vietnam, and he retired as a first sergeant. So these guys, I told somebody one day, if you want to verify that I was in Korea, talk to John here, and if you wanted to verify that I was in Vietnam, talk to Rich Lewis. Rich Lewis was a PFC, a corporal in Charlie Company Tanks in Vietnam when I was a lieutenant. And John Collins, who retired as a warrant officer, was in one of those trucks when we got ambushed. So I have taken a great effort to contact all of my former friends, especially the ones in the company I was in Vietnam. I haven't done as well as I did with the Korean group, but we get together, and at one time, men that was in my platoon met at my house and another time at Miramar Air Station, and I had 24, 25 of the original nearly 200 men. And half of that company, there were 71 enlisted regulars and 61 Marine reserves in that company. So I've met with all a whole mess of them at my house, and we talk about our previous combat. And I think that's so, so important to go to these reunions and talk to your buddies. And I could go on and on about that. So, have I answered your question?
Sir? Yeah, no, you have. And you know what? It's interesting, Don, because you're an old Corps Marine, which we all know is the day before I got in. But a lot of guys with your experience, they came home and they put it in the closet and they don't talk about it. And so it's interesting to hear that you have consistently, you know, hosted events and spoken about it, and that you advocate that, because a lot of guys, again, from World War II in Korea, that's not the way they did it, because there was no such diagnosis as PTSD. You know, you couldn't put your hand up and say, hey, I need to go to mental health like you can now. And where we understand that, hey, you got to treat his mind and his brain as well as, you know, get him to the gym and get him fit again after he comes home. So it's very interesting. It's very interesting, I think, that you you have embraced that for such a long period of time. Did your units, the guys who you've done it with, did you have much of a problem with suicide and PTSD?
No, I don't think we did. I made and several other men from Bravo Company Tanks made an attempt to round everybody up. One of the fellas had, which I have a copy of, had the Incheon roster. When we went to Incheon, these were the men that were in. So it seemed like maybe I knew a dozen of them and where they was at, you know, and so we shared that information to create little reunions from our company. And one of the phenomena is 40 years later or what have you, a wife is sitting there, four or five of you are talking, and she said, well, I've been married to him for 40 years, and he never mentioned that once. He never talked about these things. And that's what we was doing. We were airing old actions, and maybe somebody had a guilty feeling that they didn't do the proper job or something. But we talked about the things we did as young men and the problems we had in combat and our experiences. And the wives couldn't believe the things they heard that husband who'd lived with them 30, 40, 50 years hadn't mentioned it. So that's what I've experienced. And I think that talking to your buddies, talking to your friends, will resolve a lot of your mental problems before they ever become a problem. And that's what I'd like to leave you with, sir.
Well, Don, I will tell you that it's such great advice coming from you because, again, Marines of your generation, tended not to do that. So, first of all, thank you very much for your time again today. And I hope it wasn't too much of an imposition. Your story is an incredible one. And I want to thank you for coming on and not only sharing your combat experiences, but also your mental health advice, which means the world coming from somebody who's who fought at the Chosin Reservoir and a little piece of Marine Corps history. So thank you very much for coming on, and probably a more important thank you for the good advice.
Thank you, and I will talk to you at any time that you ask me to. Give me a warning. Find out if I'm home and not committed. But I've enjoyed being able to give you my story, a little bit of it. There were many, many things I did not touch upon, I had a full career. I enjoyed it. I'm very proud that I was a Marine, and all of my associates know that I'm a Marine because I'm usually wearing a cap that says U.S. Marine Corps on it. So that causes you to run into people that you might not otherwise have had the opportunity to talk to.
No, they see that the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor, and they'll yell at you. They'll say hi to you. And so, I'll tell you what, Don, we will certainly do this again. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And I will have you on again, and we will talk about whether we come have you back on and talk about post combat related mental health and those kind of issues, or just talk about your Korea and Vietnam experiences. But I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
You bet. That is Don Bennett, Major, United States Marine Corps, and a veteran of both the Korean War and the Vietnam War. And very privileged to have him on this morning. We're going to take a quick break. Mike Musselman joins us next as we do the Mike and Mike segment here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.